Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hello and welcome to Minda Dialogue, episode number 162. This interview is with Mark Schaefer, the globally recognized author, educator, and speaker on marketing strategy. Author of 5 best-selling marketing books, including The Tao of Twitter, Return on Influence, and this year, Content Code, Mark also co-hosts with Tom Webster a fabulous and unmissable marketing podcast. In this podcast, together with Mark, we talk about branding and how companies can better drive trust. We look at how top executives should be driving the digital agenda within their companies and also explore the issues of privacy for marketers. A most zesty interview. Welcome to the Minda Dialogue podcast, where we discuss brand marketing with a focus on all things digital. I am Minda Dial, your host and author of The Mindset. That's MYNDSET.com. where branding gets personal. You'll find the show notes to the blog for the upcoming interview. Let's cut to the quick and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Minda Dialogue. Today I'm sitting in beautiful Montreal and I'm piped in with someone who I've been listening to, reading, and really enjoying, Mark Schaefer. So tell us who you are, what you do, and what is your mindset, Mark? Welcome to the show.
Well, first of all, that's a very kind of you to say. It always just blows me away when people spend time with my podcast or my blog or my book. So thank you very much. I am, I guess, in my heart, I'm a teacher in everything that I do. I am an educator at Rutgers University, and I feel that whenever I speak or give a workshop or write, that I'm always kind of in a teaching frame of mind. And as far as my mindset, I think that really what I try to live every day, it's really a mindset of reinvention, I think. And it's curious because the reinvention seems to be coming faster and faster these days. I went through a period of my career where about every 5 years I reinvented myself. I kind of went from journalism to corporate communications and corporate communications to sales and then sales into global marketing. And then I became an entrepreneur and a teacher. And these days, I think the mindset has to be constant reinvention. It always makes me a little sad when I see a Twitter bio or a bio on LinkedIn that starts with the word former. And it's like, yeah. I want to know what you're doing today. How are you being bold today? How are you making a difference today? And I think we need to be constantly looking around ourselves in 360 degrees. What's going on in the world? How is it going to impact me? How do I need to adjust?
So first point of call, reevaluate your bio, guys, so that you are showing what you're doing today. Makes me think of something that really drives me bonkers in France, where they will write up a new promotion for somebody in the sort of the pink or the financial portions of the papers. I think of the Figaro in particular. And so they have these little things. It would be something like Mark W. Schaefer, comma, age, comma, graduated from high school or college,
comma,
from certain such a college. So we've done already two lines of this little thing, and none of which tells you anything. Yeah. I mean, it tells you where you went to school 30 years ago. I mean, in my case. And I just, and then such got promoted to, not why they got promoted to it, or, you know, what they did in order to get promoted to it. That's just, that's how it is. Anyway, go me crazy.
Yeah. I mean, how really relevant is age today? How really relevant is, I mean, the stuff I learned in the university prepared me for maybe my first 2 years in the workforce. And then after that, it's reinvention.
Well,
I even
think my business school taught me nothing. It taught me what to do in 40 years' time. Because I remember, if you had to fire 1,000 people at a time, what would you do? How would you do that? I'm like, wait a second. I don't even have a team of one yet. Mark, you were just talking about reinvention. I know we didn't plan this, but what do you think of the Google shift? Because that I would say is an example of always trying to reinvent, on the fly in a very new, novel way. What's your spin on the Google spin?
Well, I admire Google in some ways. I think the new structure is needed. I think it solves a lot of problems. I think it provides much needed focus. One of the things I worried about with Google is that they were just into so many diverse things. Mm-hmm. How can you really be focused on search if you're also working on self-driving cars and the million other things that they're working on? So I think the new structure really provides focus. Now, the one thing that I wonder about is they have this so admired, and it's an iconic company, and it has a very famous kind of a famous reputation as an amazing place to work, and a lot of young people I think look up to Google, and rightfully so. But this whole mantra of fail fast bothers me, because if you look at some of the greatest products, some of the greatest inventions in history, never would have made it if they had this fail fast. And even some of the greatest products we're seeing on the market today might have taken years to develop. Sometimes you need patience. You need iteration. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the failure has nothing to do with the product and everything to do with the timing. Mm-hmm. So, and from my own experience, I've been involved in projects that had this fail fast mentality. And as you look back a couple of years later, you thought, oh my gosh, if we would have just stuck that out for another year, we would have been the first to market. Look how successful this is today. So it's something that, it's a big part of their culture, but I'm not a fan of that.
Well, just thinking about I worked for L'Oréal for 16 years, and we had the culture of new. N-E-W, put that on anything you can. And I kind of think that's almost the counterpart to fail fast. It was all about, creating something new, whatever it is, as long as we can write new on it, that's good. And it comes back to a little bit the fail fast kind of mentality. I mean, even if it might be iterative in some regards, you're layering on a new component. Instead of 13.2 less wrinkles, you have 13.3 less wrinkles.
Yeah. Well, I've mentioned in my blog a couple times. In fact, I wrote an entire post about a book last week called Innovation and Entrepreneurship by Peter Drucker. And I had the great fortune to actually be a student of Peter Drucker for three years. Mm-hmm. And in that book, he talks about that real great entrepreneurs, they're not the wild-haired people in the basement, blowing up things up and saying "Eureka!" It's iteration. It's building on other inventions, and I think that this idea of looking for, today one of the words going around is the unicorn. The billion-dollar idea.
The Uberizer.
I mean, there's gonna be a few of those. But most entrepreneurs want to innovate and progress in a way that avoids big risks. You want to take risks, of course, but you don't want to take a risk that you can't recover from. And so this whole idea of the this kind of like this failure manifesto, it bothers me. I don't think it's sustainable.
Yeah, I hear you. So I wanted to ask you, Mark, in terms of mindsets, one of the things that really gets me interested in, and I look at the United States in particular for it as a sort of a beacon, is how C-suite people should be looking at their presence online themselves.
Yeah.
A little bit of a different topic, but
that's a great question. And there's been a lot discussed about that and written about that. I'm a very practical person. I'm a very realistic person, and I've worked with big companies for more than 30 years, and I've worked with senior executives for more than 30 years. And I think there are a number of folks out there that say, well, you know, everybody needs to build their personal brand and everybody needs to be representing their company on social media. And I don't necessarily agree. If you look at the pressures of the C-suite and all the things they need to be working on and the intense pressure on their time, do you really want these people to be tweeting? Do you really want these people to be blogging? If I'm a board of director on the board of directors, I'd be kind of wondering, geez, madam, is this really the best way you can be spending your time? It's almost like should the CEO be doing the company newsletter? Well, the answer is no. Now, what I do think appropriate is that the C-suite needs to know enough about the digital space to lead. I don't think they necessarily need to be, but they need to know enough to ask the right questions. I think that's what leadership is about. Mm-hmm. Now, if they happen to enjoy that sort of thing, if you're an executive that really loves to write and you want to be a thought leader and you want to lend your views and your passion to the brand, well, I think that's a bonus. I think that's fantastic. But I would never set an expectation of a C-suite executive that you've got to be online, you've got to tweet, if they really don't have any interest in that.
Yeah, I wonderful thought. But so I've got a couple of examples of situations that have happened, and I think that are emblematic of C-suite not being, A, enough to know how to do it and, you know, make the judgments, and two, since they don't actually do it or are on it, they don't even check it. And in the end of the day, I'm talking about customer experience. So my one example is Louis Vuitton in Paris, where one of their stores, they had this digital window where you go and you can sign up for stuff and you interact with the window. It's not an interactive window, but it tells you what to do. You can get an app and check this new information out and surf and, you know, exclusive stuff. Well, it turns out after 2 minutes and 13 seconds on a 4G network, on a local telephone, in the rain, in the sun, sorry, the thing fails. And the irony of this is that I went there 2 months ago and the thing failed 2 months ago. So the deal is this, is that how can this continue on for 2 months? Is this the messaging you want as the most luxurious brand in the world to be spending? And so why has that not been checked?
Yeah, you know, everything communicates. Everything you say, everything you don't say, everything you do, and everything you don't do communicates about your brand. And so I think that's a wonderful example where in a case like that, as the CEO or someone in the C-suite, you're basically the chief keeper of the brand, among other things. Mm-hmm. And if there's something like that, if there's anything that's getting in the way of the customer experience for a luxury brand like that, then, I mean, it has to rise to the top immediately, just absolutely no question, and spare no expense getting the thing fixed.
Mm-hmm. But again, well, for me, the challenge is having that obsession drilled down into the organization. And so, you know, if the CEO said, well, you know, it's really important, but, you know, I don't want to do it, it doesn't really fly for me, or at least it doesn't fly. It won't drill down into the organization so that the next level of people will be operating well, you know, you must do it, but I'm not going to check.
I think it really, your example really falls into this same idea. I was talking about where the C-suite needs to know enough to ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. In this case, that the C-suite, they're not going to fix it. They're not going to do the coding, but they need to understand how this fits into the brand ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And understand what is the impact, and then take the steps to correct it immediately.
Well, the other thing, though, is the customer experience. And so let's go back to our talked about person, Mr. Jobs, the notion of understanding what the customer is going through. And if you're sitting in the C-suite and the agency comes in and gives you a pitch, 45 minutes, hey, you know, this is what you need to be doing. You should be doing more interactive windows and so on and so forth. So as much as you want to be intelligent and understand the concepts, what's our return on investment going to be, the number of downloads, okay, I can kind of get all that. But the notion of the customer experience, which is part of the brand experience, you need to have an obsession. So my feeling is the CEO should think about, well, what is the average person going to be doing in the street? And how are they going to be interacting with this window? And is that a good experience?
Absolutely.
At the very least, ask that question.
I find with the best executives, it's an instinct, and I think there's a lot of power in that. I had an experience where I got to work on a project with Harley Davidson, and I was in the metals business, and we had developed this metal where it would resist dirt and grime, so it would always be shiny. As a piece on the bike. Now, intellectually, you're thinking, wow, this is a breakthrough. This, the people are going to fall over themselves trying to get this. So we met with the CEO of Harley-Davidson, who I'm a little foggy, but I think it was the grandson or something. And he looked at this and he said, no, you don't understand. Our customers like to shine their bikes. They touch it. They interact with it. That's how they commune with our product. We don't want it to resist grime. Now, that is a thing of beauty to me. Yeah. This is a CEO that knows the product and knows the customer so well that he can just react on instinct like that and just know what they need to do to be great. Even if it seems like a wonderful iteration and a great breakthrough. He said, nope, my customers love to touch the bike.
Yeah. my L'Oreal days, in a very similar kind of vein, L'Oreal is not very good at doing styling products. They have a big business in it, but one of their big problems is they always think it has to be extremely clean. So like there's an intellectual component to how you should do this with the scientists, and they try to make this great styling products. But it inevitably has to be noble and clean, therefore clean, as opposed to dirty, like get out of bed, naughty, which just doesn't fit with the same vibe. So I love that, the Hogs example. So listen, Mark, another topic that really I would like to share and talk with you about is this notion of privacy. And it's maybe hot because of our friends at Ashley Madison. But where I go with this is that I think that the C-suites are not enough aware of what's going on in terms of privacy, whether it's the privacy policy, whether it's the security component versus the being open and sharing, transparent, and then even as a personal, as an individual online. So let's say that they are not online, but they are surely using their BlackBerry or their mobile, and they are probably interacting occasionally, even though they don't want to, on Facebook with their grandchildren. Are they aware of their own privacy settings? And so that's sort of, I wanted to see where you wanted to take that, this whole notion of privacy for executives.
Well, this is really a hot button topic with me. And I'm so glad that you brought it up because I'm passionate about this idea. And it's really a major theme of the new book I have out called The Content Code. Yeah. And in this book, one of the things I bring up is this idea of trust really being central to a brand. Now, we talk about that. Mm-hmm. It's almost assumed today. Mm-hmm. But because of the issues of privacy, of there's a whole new level of expectations around trust. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some of the things going on out there today, we talked about Google earlier. You know, here's a company that is routinely being sued over privacy issues. Mm-hmm. If you look at Facebook, this is a company last year that really, I think, should be ashamed of some of the arrogant things that they've done with personal information. Mm. I go and visit. I'm very fortunate to work with a lot of big companies, a lot of big brands, and I am aghast at what businesses are doing with private information. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of laws around this yet. The laws have not caught up with the ability that we have in the digital space. But that doesn't mean you do something because you can. Mm-hmm. And so I'm searching for what company is going to finally stand up and say, we're going to differentiate ourselves because we will never, ever do anything to put you and your information in this kind of a situation. We're going to have a code of ethics. We don't care about what the law says. We're going to go beyond the expectations of the law because we realize the law can't keep up with the issues. And so we're going to create the standards, and we're going to publish those standards, and we're going to have ombudsmen who keep us accountable. We're going to have transparencies. Name a company that's doing that. Hmm. None that I know of.
Yeah. Well, Europe has got another spin on privacy, and I would say probably the government or the European regulatory bodies are leading more the idea of defending the consumer more, I would say, than in the United States.
Yeah, I mean they're trying to regulate it, and I think there's even limits to that because once you regulate it,
it's about breaking the rules.
There's going to be new. It's going to change. It's going to be obsolete. So. At the end of the day, this has to be driven by business. If you look this is kind of a weird way to look at things, but I mean, any major societal changes are really driven by businesses, not governments. Yeah. If you look at what's going on with environmental changes and how companies are changing their products, it's because they're responding to their customers. It's because they're responding to what needs to be done. I know a lot of people have bad views of big companies, but I also think there's a good role that companies mm-hmm. play. That they are leading a lot of this change. A lot of the change going on with improving workplaces. In places like China or the Philippines or something mm-hmm. like that. It's not taking place because of regulations. It's because of companies are being proactive in these things. Mm. They need to do the things to compete. And I think that the same thing is going to happen on the privacy front as well. And I don't understand why companies aren't stepping up in a more forceful way. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons might be because the company that stands out, that's probably mm-hmm. going to be the first company that's going to have a target on their back for hackers. Mm-hmm. I think, and this is very, very sad, that today trust is a point of differentiation for a company. Mm-hmm. I think people are seeking this, and if you can find that company that really can connect to you in a human way, in a rare and human way, those are the companies that are going to win.
So the first point makes me think of the CVS move to not sell cigarettes in pharmacies. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. what they had to evaluate from a business standpoint was the delta between the loss of business of the cigarettes to the bonus and the feel-goodness and maybe trust factor that came mm-hmm. from no longer selling cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good example. And, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, yes, they probably did some calculation, but I think and I hope maybe there was a noble aspect of this. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was an aspect to this that said, you know, we're all about wellness. How can we possibly be aligned with wellness if we're proactively profiting from cigarettes? So I would hope that played into the thing, and I think maybe that will go into this this idea of building trust. I think that's a good example.
So now I'm riffing off with it. Let's say there are a couple of industries that seem to stand out and probably have to do more of this idea that you're talking about, which are the pharmaceuticals and the banking industries for different reasons. But in the end of the day, let's say a Sanofi or a Rhône Poulenc or whomever goes out and you know, becomes the, you know, writes down the standard, the charter. At the same time, really, is that going to do anything when you still have Google and Facebook and so on doing all the things that they do behind, and or the credit card companies trying to mine all the data? Is it possible for a single company to put a flag in, you know, on the beach and say, this is what we believe, and you know, look, we do what we have my ombudsman in place, but you know, the fact is that the ecosystem around it means that you're just sort of going to be laughed at.
Well, but that's a keen question with a lot of rich implications. I think the first thing is that you use the examples of pharmaceutical and banking, and the first point that comes to mind is that this connects the dots with the previous thing we were talking about, regulation. Those are industries. I think those are amazing examples of industries that are highly regulated, and the regulations are actually keeping them back from doing the right things in some in some cases. That the regulations maybe were created in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s to this world. And then, you know, what does it take to deregulate some of these things? Mm-hmm. So that's a great example where the answer is not government regulation. The answer is companies
doing
the right thing, doing the right thing and standing out. Now, so that brings us to the second piece, is there hope for companies wanting to do that? And I think there is, because an example of a bank to say, look, we know that your privacy is really our ultimate goal. We're a bank. And so here is our pledge. Here is our pledge to you that we will spare no expense on security, that we will have defense industry standard security encryption for our bank. We will lead in security. If something would ever happen here, you know, this is going to be our response to you. Here is our pledge to you. Here is how we will assure you that you will never be put at some disadvantage banking with us and having something out of your control. I don't know any bank that has a policy like that. I don't know of any bank that is saying in some banks, it's funny, there's actually the word trust in their name.
But
in this world of deep concern, and here's the issue, this problem is going to get much, much worse because we're in this world of malignant complexity on the web. Nobody understands how the web works anymore. And the more complex it gets, the more vulnerable we become. And so eventually, I'll make a prediction. In the next 12 months, I think we will see some companies start to stand out and say, we're going to lead. We're going to lead in this area of trust and our online presence and our online pledge to you.
So where I'm thinking is, having been researching this for quite a lot over the summer, I kind of categorized three areas of breaching the trust. The first is, as a company, you want to have a personalized recommendation. Mr. Schaefer, I need to know a little bit more about you in order to give you a great deal that makes you really feel satisfied. Oh, great. Well, the consequences of that is I need to have access to a lot more information than you're prepared to give to me. Then the second level is hackers. And so they go in and they can breach your statements, as you mentioned before. And so you have to have that protection against that and, you know, private your credit card information and all that kind of stuff. And we've seen so many examples of that happening. And then the third level is still all the same, government inspection. And so backdoor access to data that they're sort of enforcing on banks, for an example, in order to, you know, under the guise of, you know, protecting us from terrorists and so on. So these three components are really, as you say, this, complex world.
Well, I recently came across this research. I think it's one of the most important pieces of research that I've seen in terms of the impact on marketing. And I'll send you the link so you can include it in your show notes, or in case any of your listeners want the link. But we can't do anything about hackers. I mean, the hackers are going to do whatever they're going to do. This is kind of out of our control in many ways. The government is kind of out of control in many ways. But here's what we can control as marketers. We can control what we do with personal information, our policy with personal information. And here was the big finding of this research. Consumers are not okay trading private information for deals and personalization and coupons. They're not. And marketers justify collecting and leveraging this information, but consumers are not okay with that. And the word they used was resigned. Mm-hmm. They're resigned to the fact that they have no privacy today because these marketers are going to take our information and do whatever they want with it anyway. Mm-hmm. We're killing ourselves as an industry. We're killing ourselves as a profession by justifying it because we're creating a benefit from the consumer. The consumer doesn't buy into that. Mm-hmm. And so again, it goes back to my point. When is a marketer going to stand up and say, look, we're not going to do anything with this that you don't agree with? And it's not going to be some stupid privacy policy that's legalese and whereas this and whereas that that's going to take 2 hours to read. We're going to state very, very clearly in three or four bullet points, this is our pledge to you. This is our promise to you. We're never going to do something with that personal information unless you explicitly agree to what's happening here.
Well, I would love that. And my sort of critical eye would say until we have an Amazon or a Google, or Chris, Apple to a degree has tried to put down a line in the sand on this topic. But I think that we are... Whereas I think it is the malignancy of our time. And marketers have constantly disappointed consumers. And so that's why they are so low on the ranking trust and that whatever it is that Ipsos or there's like a survey that comes out and shows how marketers are just about as low as used car salespeople in terms of trustworthiness. And so we have this whole new opportunity out there. But if we don't do it the right thing, then it's just going to keep on getting bad. And you're going to get more ad blocking. You're going to get more, people, I would say, why be loyal to a brand if we know they're all being bad to us?
Yeah, I mean, I think in this day and age, there's no more important marketing we can achieve than personal, organic advocacy. And to create a group of customers who proactively promote you, who love you, mm-hmm. and tell other people that they love you, there's got to be an emotional connection to that company and to that brand. And it's just like any relationship. It's built on trust. That is the foundation. If there's no trust, you're never going to have advocacy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we one of the things I talk about constantly in my speeches and my classes and in the book is we're a marketing culture obsessed with traffic. Mm-hmm. These people are tourists. They're not creating any value to our brand. What we really need to be focused on, especially in luxury goods, is the idea of trust. Trust. That creates advocacy. That leads to loyalty. In the end, loyalty trumps everything. It doesn't matter what happens in the digital space. Doesn't matter what the next Facebook is. We'll figure all that stuff out. But loyalty, no matter what the platform, no matter what the hot digital technique is tomorrow, we need to be focused on creating a human presence that really creates an emotional connection with our customers that leads to loyalty.
So my last wig out on this portion, Mark, is as a company, so companies are really constituted by a set of people, and then you have these different corporate structures. And I'm thinking that the fact that publicly traded companies are in such deep doo-doo on a quarterly level, their ability to gauge and wage the long-term battle of that you're talking about, it's unlikely to be a publicly traded company that's going to do it unless they have an extremely high percentage of the company owned by the owner, like a Brin or Page or Bezos. The second thing I'm thinking about is the brands within a company, because you can have, you know, if we talk to big companies like that you work with, I can be a big brand, but my corporate brand is not a commercially traded brand. And so the trust that you're talking about, is that with the corporation or the individual small brand that's a part of the big brand, let's say GMC as a part of General Motors or Pontiac? And then, or I'm in another case, I'm the corporate brand is the commercial brand, and therefore there's a stronger link, another Apple. It's Apple Inc. and it's Apple traded.
You ask really good questions. Oh, boy. We are really going down an interesting rabbit hole here. That people would have an emotional connection to the brand itself. So it might be like, you know, Cadillac. I have this image in my mind of my father driving a Cadillac and how pink he loved Cadillac. His Cadillac. And I'm making this up. My dad did not drive a Cadillac.
It wasn't pink either.
I'm just reaching here,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, or there's a certain product that's just like always been used in my family. So I feel good about this. And here's my, I think there's always a place for that. I always think there's a place for heritage and legacy. We're always going to have warm feelings about certain brands just because of, you know, who they are and what they stand for.
Sure.
But if you look at the greatest brands, the greatest legacy brands, something like Disney, Coca-Cola, Nike, they have to reinvent themselves every generation. They have to find out how to be relevant to the next to the emotions and the values of the next group coming along. And so I think we, in some ways, we can rely less. We have to rely less on the legacy and the heritage. And here's my sense that, especially with the millennials, they're the least trusting generation in history. All the research shows that they don't trust anybody but themselves. They will trust content shared on the web by a stranger before they'll trust your brand messaging and advertising. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of this reinvention, part of this reconnection with the next generation, I think there has to be some human element to it. I think that because there is this mistrust of labels and brands, that the smartest brands are going to connect people to people. And here's an example. The Hilton hotel chain has this Twitter handle called Hilton Suggests. Mm-hmm. And they look for people having travel problems. in certain cities in the world. You know, they're expressing exasperation on Twitter because the heel on their shoe just broke or whatever. And Hilton will go on and they will try to help these people no matter where they are or what their problem is, even if they're not staying at the hotel. Mm-hmm. Because this is a human personal expression mm-hmm. of their brand identity of just making it the best place to travel. It's just helping travelers, you know, just ease their issues in every single way. And so they're connecting real people with real people. Mm-hmm. And that is helping them create this emotional connection that hopefully will lead to loyalty and trust down yeah. the line. And I think we'll be – my sense is that we'll be seeing more of this type of thing. We'll need to be seeing more of this thing because I think that's really where the values are leading in this next generation.
Mm-hmm. And on top of that, so it's real people, real problems in real time. Mm-hmm. I love that. Mark, oh, fabulous. Sneaking impression, this I could have done this for a couple more hours. But time is of the essence, and I promised a departure speedily in a couple minutes. So, Mark, tell us what's the best way for us. How would you like people to connect with you, read with you? I know we're going to put lots of little fun show notes about you.
Well, I always love hearing from people that might have listened and heard me on a podcast, so I'd love for your listeners to connect with me. You can find everything about me at businessesgrow.com, and you can find my books there, my blog, the podcast I do called The Marketing Companion with my friend Tom Webster.
Absolute must.
And oh, thank you. We have a lot of fun.
You do, and I do too. Listening,
and it's very entertaining. And So businessesgrow.com, you can find all my social connections there, and I'd love to hear from people.
Hey, listen, thanks for coming on the show. It's been wonderful hanging with you. Look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes on themindset.com. That's mindset with a Y, where you can also sign up for my weekly newsletter at /subscribe. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes. That really makes my day. Happy trails, and enjoy Josh Sachs's Painted Fingers.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way to rid me of the gray and heal me with all your imperfections that you mention in your lack of security. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm, wrapped in canvas, hold me tightly. Slowly we would paint a lover's portrait with all your favorite shades, and we'd paint blend and look ugly in the end, but they're pretty in their own disgusting values. We'd hang our portraits in the hallways, make our house guests cringe. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm seeing all your colors. We'll be right back. with all your favorite shades, and we paint it with our fingers to show the world the way we feel. Oh, oh, the way I feel.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I want to tell you about my podcast called Can I Offer You Some Feedback? I'm a business consultant and executive coach with over 20 years' experience in change management, leadership development, and naturally providing feedback to high performers. My podcast is for those of you who have a complicated relationship with feedback, whether giving, receiving, avoiding, or seeking. Feedback is essential for our development. In each episode, you'll hear from real people across industries with their ideas, perspectives, and best practices on feedback. I'll also be sharing business bites with you, simple explanations of organizational tools, management techniques, and leadership philosophies that will help you and your businesses thrive. You can listen to Can I Offer You Some Feedback on your favorite podcast app or learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.